Harris English is back on top with his fifth PGA Tour victory this weekend. He's travelled a long road back from injury, and the man who helped him on that journey is here to tell us how English got it done. Justin Parsons, one of the best coaches in the game, joins us. And some weeks in golf, the focus is less on who wins than on how long it takes them to win. Slow play is back centre stage early in this 2025 season, and fans are rallying round the broadcaster who said everyone needs to get a move on. We'd waste no time in getting to that topic. And the LPGA Tour kicks off its 75th season with a lot of uncertainty around its sponsors and without a permanent commissioner. How soon will that ship be steadied? All of that and more. Golf Today gets underway right now.
Golf Today.
Welcome into Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside Jordan Cornett. It was a Saturday finish on the PGA Tour, something we only see once a year. I assume you're actually a fan of that since you were probably watching that football thing that was going on yesterday.
I was going to say it opened up your Sunday to watch some big-time NFL, some football for you. I figured you'd be excited about that, Eamon, no?
I have one sport that I like to watch on Sunday, and it ain't football.
It ain't that. Look,
but should golf get more creative with
It's a shrewd decision that was made a few years ago, and rightfully so. You can never compete with not only football and the juggernaut it is in this country, but the fact that it's the biggest game outside, the two biggest games outside the Super Bowl. Like, there's such an interest in it. And I think back just to last week watching the American Express and having to toggle back and forth because slow pace of play, which we'll talk about here very soon, impacting that. I'm flipping back and forth. You don't want to compete with the NFL, any sport, let alone golf. So I like the fact that it turns into a true sports weekend. I also get to golf a day earlier in the week. I love that setup.
Well, I'm sure later in the show you can tell me what actually happened in this football game yesterday.
Air blowouts.
Well, it was a Saturday finish at Torrey Pines. As we noted, Harris English made it back-to-back winners circle, a one-shot victory in the Farmers Insurance Open. It was the first win since the 2021 Travelers Championship, and it comes after a pretty slow start to the season, which included a missed cut in the Sony and at the American Express. And with that victory, he racks up this list of awards: 500 FedEx Cup points, a healthy bank deposit, entry into the 2025 signature events, an invitation to the Masters, an exemption into the PGA Championship, and he is fully exempt through the 2027 PGA Tour season. But as usual in golf, nothing's ever quite as simple as it seems. Harris English, thoroughly deserving winner of the Farmers Insurance Open. But the talking point, at least as far as fans and social media went, was on a subject entirely different. Let's take a look and a listen to what happened during the CBS broadcast between Frank Nobilo and Dottie Pepper.
Harris English, nearly 3 hours after he teed off the opening hole, tees off the 10th hole.
You know, Frank, I think we're starting to need a new word to talk about this pace of play issue and its respect for your fellow competitors, for the fans, for broadcasts, for all of it. It's just got to get better.
There you are, Jordan. That's a sign that not all heroes wear capes. Some actually wear headsets out there. And let's go Dottie Pepper here. She's entirely right on this idea of respect. And we all know that the conditions were challenging out there, but they weren't that challenge. And frankly, it's an outdoor sport. If these guys need consistent, calm conditions, then go play top golf if that's what they want to do. But this isn't a new problem on the PGA Tour. We hear it's not even a new problem at Torrey Pines. We had the same issue with JB Holmes a few years ago. But the context is a little different now because the PGA Tour doesn't have a very deep reservoir of goodwill with the fans right now. Player greed has seen.
Are you talking about the money?
Right.
Absolutely.
Now. And they ought to be giving medals to Tommy Roy at NBC and Seller Shai at CBS, the tournament producers who actually saved the fans from an even worse experience than what's actually going on by not going to the slow players very often. But the tour is working on this fan-forward strategy, and Jay Monahan has talked about it, the tour officially has talked about it, and there's going to be a lot more to come on that. But this is, it's something of a toxic trait that has existed for a very long time. It's not new to me. For many years, Slugger White was the rules official on the PGA Tour. And a number of years ago, before he retired, Slugger White gave an interview to Golf Digest in which he said that he would never inflict a stroke penalty on anyone for slow play in case that cost them the money that made the difference between sending their kids to college or not. That's the kind of paternalistic gibberish that has actually governed this issue for a long time on the PGA Tour. It just feels as though a reckoning needs to happen, but we never seem to get closer to it.
Yeah, I mean, look, with TGL, and granted, you're not dealing with the conditions, you're not dealing with some of the challenges that are out there playing actual golf, but you can see these golfers can play with pace. It's possible to do. And so to me, look, Eamon, I'm just going to be very candid. There's nothing. Let your mind wander. For 5.5 hours, there's nothing that I want to do. For 5.5 hours. And outside of sleeping for 5.5 hours, that's what I want to do. So to watch a final round again play like this, and it's not going in the direction of getting closer to being fixed, it's going actually the opposite direction, all I think about is how do you fix a problem? Accountability. And what does accountability look like? Are there bigger fines? There's data to point out who the issues are with. I love that Dottie used the word respect, because that becomes a scarlet letter, or several scarlet letters across the chest, if you will. If you're identifying those who are disrespectful to the game in a game that is losing so much goodwill, could that possibly be a solution? There has to be more avenues to explore. As we come into the show and we talk about, hey, we love that this past weekend was played to a Saturday, not to combat with football, an adjustment made a few years ago. A sound move that I think made for better viewership. With slow pace of play, how many Golf Today shows, how many podcasts, how many events where you're listening to the broadcast, does this have to come up before you say, we need to actually, tactfully attack this problem to at least get on the right side of it? Look, if baseball, who lives in the past, America's pastime for crying out loud, will say, hey, let's go to a shot clock, let's go to a pitch count or a pitch clock, let's move this thing up, and it's worked. Not saying the shot clock will solve all, but if that sport's open to a change, there's no reason why our beautiful game of golf shouldn't be.
Yeah, part of the problem with golf is that the accused are actually the jury here, because any change has to come from the players, and the players aren't necessarily historically of a mind to tell each other to rush up. They're not getting the cattle prod out for each other. And in baseball, it did make a difference. You go back pre-shot clock, the average baseball running time for a game was 3 hours and 5 minutes. After the shot clock, 2 hours, 35 minutes. That's a significant time savings. And that's why it's interesting in golf now, because that decision was made by the owners who realized that their product is suffering. Well, golf now has owners as well. If you're John Henry or Steve Cohen or Arthur Blank or the other SSG guys, what you are now looking at is a consumer-facing part of your product that is not good, that demands action. And it's going to be an interesting issue now as we move forward on this. Does the impetus for any change, if it comes at all, does it bubble up from the Player Advisory Committee, as is in the rules of the tour to do so, or is it imposed from the top from the owners to actually change this?
Well, and I smile because nowhere do you mention the players and maybe a feeling of responsibility to maybe feel a little bit more uncomfortable, but for the betterment of the product. But why would they care? Why would they be incentivized? The money's not impacting them. They're being paid as well as they ever have. So for them, where are they going to feel like, okay, our game is being hurt, but it's not necessarily hurting them in their pockets for some of them to come over. But you would think, and it goes back to Dottie's use of the word respect, you would think the respect of the game, to want to grow the game, which is everybody's collective mission, would be all in on this to change it in that regard. But we just haven't seen that yet.
And we certainly know that monetary fines don't work. If stroke penalties are imposed, well, you're now in an era in golf where there's even fewer cards out there. There's fewer access to tournaments. There's fewer pathways for these guys. So the strokes might actually have a lot more impact now than they may have had a few years ago. But it's time now for another Golf Today roundtable, as we welcome in Rex Hoggart, golf.com senior writer, and our own George Savarikas. Rex, I want to start with you. You always have an opinion on this slow play. Sometimes you're actually subjected to it out there. Does the tour have a genuine problem on its hands here, or is this just another kind of outrage cycle that we see every once in a while?
No, it's obviously a general problem. It's an outrage, is what it is. And I loved what Dottie said. I actually rewound it and watched it a couple of times when she said it in the middle of the telecast. And I love the idea of respect, but I'll add another word to this. This is about will. The tour's lack of a will to enforce the penalties that they already have in place. I'm not talking about putting new things, new regulations in place to try to speed up play. Just go to what you have and enforce it, because I'm with you. The money's not going to make a difference. The only way you're going to make a difference if you start assessing one-stroke penalties, and that's the difference between you finishing 50th or 51st on this year's FedEx Cup points list, suddenly you are going to start playing faster. And I will go to TGL. The PGA Tour has the cheat code. Just tune in tonight when Tiger plays Rory's team. The 40-second shot clock works. The players can play fast. I know you're taking the elements out of it being in that arena. However, you can do this on the golf course in some sort of limited capacity and speed up play if you had the will.
George, what's your solution?
And I agree overall holistically with Rex. I think from a functionality standpoint, golf's the most complex sport you can have when you have 78 players playing at once the first half of the field if it's a 156-man event. So then you have, what, spotters that are having to wear a shot clock. The PGA Tour's policy when it comes to pace of play was enacted in 1994. It has been feckless for the last 31 years. In 1995, Glenn Day was the last guy to get a shot penalty. Since then, they've only gone with fines, and the problem has gotten substantially worse over time. And there's a competitive imbalance. Slow players impact fast players. Fast players do not impact slow players, because slow players know they're only going to pay a monetary fine. But to them, that small fine comparatively is so much less than what the purses are, that there's no incentive structure for them to actually change their pace of play. I was watching Ludvig Åberg last week, was doing one of the streams on ESPN Plus for the Farmers Insurance Open. He is one of the fastest players on the PGA Tour. The second his playing partner had hit their shot, he was already stepping into his. There are very small material changes that the PGA Tour can act from a policy standpoint as far as making sure guys are ready to play their shots instead of, when we pan to a guy, he then begins his whole process with the player caddy conversation that we've grown accustomed to airing. Then they talk for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, then they step into their shot. I do think penalizing players' shots is the only way to actually get a response. It's just, how do you execute that on such a large scale on the PGA Tour? That's why the PGA Tour rules officials have just thrown up their hands and said, this is the best we can do.
George, do you sense the stomach to face down the players on this? Or do you think the SSG private equity guys, who are now big investors in the tour, are going to grow concerned at this perception that the consumers of their product are just tired of it?
Well, Eamon, it's funny. I was Googling before the show, pace of play PGA Tour. There was an article in 2023 about changes they were going to make. There was an article in 2020, an article in 2018. It's every year or two, we have the exact same conversation and nothing changes. But when you look at, say, TGL or the attention span and how the younger generation consumes products and media, none of them want to go out and follow our final group for 5.5 hours. I totally agree with what Jordan said off the top. So if there's actually going to be substantive changes, I think SSG realizes not only is there a competitive imbalance with the players, and the slow players then dictate the pace in which these events are played at, it is not good for the product on TV, nor is it good for the in-person experience. But, Eamon, I'm still waiting for SSG. We've been hearing since that they've made their primary investment, they have these dynamic ideas and changes involved with the PGA Tour, but they haven't been forward-facing with any of those. So I'm glass half full, hopeful that they will make some type of change, but we haven't seen anything to this date.
So, Rex, this kind of goes back to, ultimately for me, JT last week making waves with his plea to his colleagues to be more accessible with media, to help grow this game. So in that vein, knowing that some of the bigger voices are open to, hey, we've got to fix problems here to help get our numbers up, what do you think the percentage is that would have an agreeance with what we're saying here? Bring in this shot clock. Let's speed things up. What do you think the percentage of pros that are saying, we're on board with this? What would you measure that, gauge that to be?
Jordan, you look at that memo that JT sent to players last week, and that was okay. It was about being more open with the media and the broadcast partners, trying to give fans a bit of a glimpse. But if you look at the DNA, this is about making the product better, and that's essentially what we're talking about when we're talking about pace of play. And to George's point, I would point out that you're right. We're having these conversations every year, every 2 years, for the better part of my entire career. The one thing that is changing going into next year that I think could impact where we are on pace of play is field size. We all know that the fields are only getting smaller. I remember having this conversation with Mark Russell, the longtime PGA Tour rules official, for so long of him lecturing me and telling me 156-player field, 144-player field cannot play fast. You run into a traffic jam. There's too many people on the golf course. Well, now the Tour has created a scenario where you don't have those. You don't have the traffic jams anymore. So as part as transitioning to that schedule and creating a different, better product for the fans, they can take a hard look at pace of play. I think we are at an inflection point where if the Tour had the will, they could change it.
George, on the subject of that Justin Thomas memo, you spend a lot of time out there interviewing players before and after their rounds. Some are more willing than others to join in on that process, and even more so, I guess, during a round. How likely do you think it is that you're going to see an uptake from players? It's certainly a positive sign, the desire to do so. Do you think enough players realize that the onus is on them a little bit more to sell their product?
I think they're slowly coming to that realization. I remember doing in-round interviews when we tested this fall of 2018. And we were trying to do it on a, say, like a 12th hole or something along those lines. It wasn't specific to a par three, but we tested it. Players were a little reticent, died on the vine for a few years. We've since brought it back, and now guys have more collective buy-in to realize, hey, the more we can allow the consumer to peek under the hood, to understand what makes us tick, what goes in the shots, what variables we're weighing, that's what you see go viral in golf, in football, in basketball, in baseball, are these easily digestible minute to 2 minute social media clips where the average fan is getting to connect with the player on seemingly what feels like, from a fan side, a personal experience. So I do think Justin Thomas, who 5 years ago, I would have been doubtful that he would have been a guy championing that message necessarily, he totally gets it. I think having someone of that stature, of that cachet, and I do think the younger rookies or guys in their early to mid-20s are quicker to say, you know what, let's give this a shot. But conversely, if you're a guy battling for your card and it's towards the end of the season, I've had guys just say, you know what, I want nothing to do with this. I just want to focus on my game right now. So there's definitely a balance, Eamon.
Well, guys, let's take a beat. Whole lot more to discuss. Jordan Spieth back from injury. Scottie Scheffler, world's number one. Rory stateside. George Rex, stick around. Eamon, are you going to stick around as well?
For a little bit.
He is. All right, more golf today. More roundtable when we return.
And let's resume our roundtable with George Savarikas and Rex Hoggard. Rex, it's a big night tonight in TGL world. It's Tiger versus Rory, Jupiter versus Boston. Is the two founders finally going head-to-head. What's your anticipation level like now for week four?
Don't want to blow out. Seen those the first 3 weeks, so I hope it's a little bit more of a closer match, although I was looking at the odds this morning. The folks in Vegas don't seem to think so. And look, it's all been angling towards this. I'll give the folks at TGL credit. The way they started the schedule, they knew there was going to be a level of interest for that opening week, just with the technology and everything that goes on inside the center. And then they trotted out Tiger the next week. That was obviously going to be a bump. And now you have the two biggest names going head-to-head. And it has been entertaining on some level. Certainly, last time Tiger played Kevin Kisner was plenty entertaining, maybe for the wrong reasons a little bit as well. But you do need to see a little bit more of a competitive environment. Everything that goes into this, the personality of the players, and we spent a lot of time talking about the idea that they need to step outside their comfort zone. And I think we've seen that a little bit more. But this is an opportunity to not only bring that to the table, but also bring a competitive match.
George, as you've watched TGL, what's been your biggest takeaway?
I love the tech in the arena. I've been pleasantly surprised by how impressive that the structure itself has looked. I would like, and the viewership numbers the first few weeks, I think ESPN has to be happy with what we've seen out of the gates. To echo Rex's sentiments, at a certain point, the novelty wanes and the competition itself, which is entertainment geared, needs to really be a hook for viewers. And the first 3 weeks, it hasn't been close. I do think that they're going to have to kind of iterate on how the matches itself are structured to maybe try and figure out a manner or a mechanism in which these become closer matches. Because if you're week seven in and it's 9-1, are you really going to grind out a 2-hour match? But I do think they're geared towards a younger audience. I like that they're taking risks. I think regardless of who launched this, you're going to find things that you applaud and find things that you nitpick. I'd be curious if other sports follow suit, because it's kind of a mix between competition and esports, which the younger demographic appears to have an appetite for.
Rex, on the subject of risk-taking and innovation, LIV announced that their first season opening event in Saudi Arabia in a few weeks will be played entirely under floodlights at night, which is something we've only seen before in made-for-TV exhibition matches, not in a tournament proper. Is this innovation at its finest or the stench of desperation?
I think somewhere in between, I would probably say. I would say it's an unnecessary gimmick in this particular case. And also, I don't even think the players are going to like it. Let's go back to December, and you had Bryson and Brooks playing under the lights in Las Vegas against Rory and Scottie Scheffler, and it was clear they weren't comfortable playing under the lights. Players will tell you all the time that it's not the same thing. You don't have the depth perception. You don't have the feel. You can't really see the shots the way you can during the day, and I don't think it's necessary. And I keep going back to last year's Olympics, and finally decided that if someone wants to wake up at 1 a.m. and watch badminton on the East Coast coming from Paris, then fine, log on to Peacock and do it whenever you wanted. And I think NBC and Peacock found success in that, because that's the way the consumers wanted to consume this particular product. I think moving to Fox Sports and getting a larger format, getting a larger platform, is going to be helpful. But doing something like this just seems like a gimmick, and it's not necessary.
George, let's go to the return of World's Number One. And we talk about, you know, fixing the game in all these ways. Well, stale leaderboards have also been somewhat of an issue. Don't necessarily expect to see Scottie Scheffler in his return here at Pebble to be at the top of that leaderboard, but he'll garner interest returning, and he's guaranteed four rounds because there is no cut at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am. What are you excited to see from World's Number One in his return?
Jordan, I wouldn't doubt the man. I mean,
you're probably right.
not a guy that I want to short. If I was buying stock on guys on the PGA Tour, Scottie Scheffler, regardless of layoff and injury at home making pasta, I love seeing the biggest names play Pebble Beach. There are certain venues that just strike a different chord, and Pebble is about as special as they get on the PGA Tour. So I think with Scottie, it'll be fun to see the first couple days as he eases in, if there are any type of changes or tweaks he's made with his game, if he's able to pick up right where he left off last year, where he had put up the best season we had seen worldwide in 20 years, just based on the high level of consistency he's played at, and it being a smaller field signature event. I think a top 15 finish is fair, but I wouldn't be shocked if Scottie Scheffler is in the mix on Sunday.
Rex, Scottie's not the only superstar making a comeback this weekend. The other guy isn't trying to recapture what he did in 2024 at all. That's Jordan Spieth coming back from wrist surgery. Golf course that he's had a tremendous amount of success at over the years. He's been a winner, a lot of top 10 finishes. What's a reasonable expectation for Jordan Spieth this week?
I think I have so much more interest to see how Jordan comes back than I do for Scottie. And I say that because I feel like Scottie probably took plenty of time to recover from that. And I'm with George. I feel like Scottie's just going to pick up where he left off. But Jordan would be such a shot in the arm for the PGA Tour. We just talked about the tour needing more personalities, and I don't think there's a better personality in the tour lineup than Jordan Spieth. But coming off the injury, coming off surgery, knowing that he's been struggling with this since 2018, knowing that these types of injuries have ended careers before, there is such an unknown quality to all of this. If he's healthy and he doesn't have to worry about, and I don't even understand the math or the science behind this, but the tendon slipping out of its sheath like it did the last few years, and just not knowing and having sort of that anxiety that every time I play golf, it could happen, I'm sure that's going to be a peace of mind. But you also want to see him take steps. So I would think that anything, given his success at Pebble Beach, as you pointed out, middle of the pack, just stick around, give yourself an opportunity, because it's been a long time since he's been in that situation.
You know, George, as Rex talks about a guy like Jordan Spieth injecting life, I look at Rory and I put almost unfair expectations on what he needs to deliver the sport this year as he gets going stateside at Pebble Beach. You know, the opportunity with the Open being in his native Ireland, and then you've got obviously his success and a major opportunity to chase a Quail Hollow. Can Rory get over, I don't want to say get over that hump, he's played great golf, but is this the year of Rory maybe that we're looking at?
I mean, it's hard to discount that Rory's going to have a if the year Rory includes a multi-win season, then you look at what he's done in his career. Yes, there's a good chance that Rory will be up to his old tricks and have, like, last year he had two PGA Tour wins, win maybe one to two other times worldwide. Is this the year that he gets over the major hump? Rory is as confounding a star as you're going to see in any sport, with how successful he has been since 2014 on the PGA Tour and how prolific a winner he has been. To then have this major drought is almost unfathomable. And it's the 10 inches between the years. And I don't know, Rory. I don't know if Rory has solved the riddle. Like, what needs to change where we see the best version of Rory, the final nine holes in a major on Sunday when he has a chance to win? And the trope that we always trot out when a guy comes up short is, oh, they're gonna learn from that experience. They're gonna learn from that experience. But I feel like Padraig Harrington said it best at the PGA Championship 4 years ago. Not all experience is positive experience. So there's been scar tissue built up. So if Rory is able to show that he is resilient and wins a major, Quail Hollow or the Open, or completes the career Grand Slam, I think that's in the running for the best story of 2025. It's hard to make a guarantee like that just based on what we've seen the last 3 or 4 years. But I mean, he's getting as close as you can without getting it done.
Skipping forward a week past Pebble Beach, George, to the WM Phoenix Open. You and I have spent some time out there over the last few years. They've promised this year it's going to be what they describe as better, not bigger, that the overserved chaos we saw last year will not happen this year. Is it possible to change the behavior or image of that tournament now? Or do you think it's possible that a for-profit PGA Tour might actually see that as something that's portable elsewhere?
I don't think you can make that portable. I mean, the number of people they have is more than the Kentucky Derby. It resembles going to Coachella, a music festival, just the sheer volume. And I've been at every Phoenix Open dating back to 2013. Predates my time at Golf Channel as a sports anchor in Arizona. I remember coming up and covering it, and you were seeing now the Coliseum, the theater around the 16th. The Thunderbirds last year, I remember Eamon sitting on set as we saw the horrible weather they had, things unfold. They immediately went to Riviera the following weeks to talk with players and say, okay, we want your feedback. We want to make positive changes. What they won't say, and I will, they had horrible luck with the weather. That was as bad a weather as I've probably seen with the Phoenix Open in 15 to 20 years. And what that did, it had rained so much, and you have a stadium amphitheater, people couldn't step off cart paths, otherwise their legs would sink to their knees. So everyone was bottlenecking in these three or four crunch points, and that's why it turned into what we saw unfold. But I thought the overall number of people, the behavior in the stands, it wasn't necessarily substantially more egregious than we've seen in years past. It was more that people were forced to go to these areas. So in talking with tournament chairman Matt Mooney, he mentioned, Eamon, what you had shared. They've tried to build significant infrastructure to allow the players to easily get from point A to point B. They really want to push fans to go towards the 12th hole. They have new entrants on the 18th and other areas of the property. The weather looks spectacular. It's going to be mid-70s and sunny the beginning of the week. I don't think you can fully put the genie back in the bottle, but I think they're right. They're making the right corrective steps where if they get a good weather week like they traditionally do, hopefully the takeaway at the end of the week is how amazing the atmosphere was and the champion was versus look at the crowd and the debauchery and what happened with the horrible weather and the mud.
Well, on one side you've got bottlenecking, and the other side you've got necking bottles. We're never sure what the problem is out there, but it's a fun couple of weeks coming up in this game. Thanks for joining us, guys. With more on the LPGA Tour season, my Golf Week colleague Bethan Nichols joins us now. Bethan, when you look at those numbers on paper, everything looks great for the LPGA Tour, but they are entering the 75th season with a temporary commissioner in Liz Murr, with Molly Marcoussi-Mann having stepped down from the role. Is that a topic of concern out there in terms of executive continuity at the tour?
Well, it's certainly a critical time, and I think we probably won't see a new commissioner named until after the first quarter. So, you know, the LPGA can't afford to spin its wheels over the next few months. They've got to keep moving. And so I found it interesting that the tour has parted ways with its chief of sales, Nicole Metzger, and they've actually expanded the role of Jody Brothers, who's been chief of the Epson Tour now for the past 2 years. Nicole Metzger was a Molly Marcuse Amon hire from 2 years ago as well. So this is a really important position for the LPGA because, you know, I think when we're talking about what we're looking for, what folks are looking for in the next commissioner, you know, a lot of times media comes up, you know, first and foremost, and understanding, which is obviously very important, of how that landscape is changing and how the LPGA can better capitalize on exposure. But the LPGA needs to excel at sales. They don't have a lot of long-term contracts on tour. You know, most everything is around the three-year mark. So they're constantly trying to either renew a sponsor or find a new one, find more marketing partners. And so having someone who understands the landscape, which Jody spent 16 years with the PGA Tour in business development prior to coming over to the LPGA. So he has a great Rolodex, but also now has a couple years under his belt working in women's golf. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of headway he can make with his team. But, you know, I think when you're looking for the next commissioner, somebody who understands sales and can move things across the finish line is really important because Mike Wan was a master at that.
Beth Ann, we can all agree on what sells its stars. And Nelly Korda is absolutely one of them. Coming off of such a sublime season with those seven wins a year ago, how can you even approach an encore and what kind of pressure is on her to deliver something like that going into the season?
You know, I've been thinking about that a little bit, and I actually think that lull that she had in the middle of the season last year is really gonna, you know, do her a lot of good because it was a big learning experience. If she had had, you know, that streak at the end of the season and then gone straight into 2025 off of that, it might have been a little bit different. But she obviously had that 5-1 streak, then had a lull, then came fighting back at the end with another victory at the Annika. So I think, you know, she learned a lot in that time frame, and I think, you know, having not really a long off season, but knowing in her mind that she's only going to play these two in Florida, and then she's going to have another extended break, and she won't go to Asia. I think that really helps her to be motivated and fresh for these two, and she's obviously going to be playing, you know, on Florida soil, which she loves and excels at.
Well, one tournament she's not going to have to worry about defending is the Fairhill Sayre Pack Championship, played in Los Angeles the last couple of years, Beth Ann, due to be played in March. It was announced last week that it's been cancelled. What's the backstory to that one?
Oh, well, it's just so unfortunate when you consider the fact that there are so few full field events here in the first quarter of the season, and it's one less event for players to try to qualify for the first major of the season, the Chevron Championship. You know, I think when you look at, it's so unusual to have an underwriter. And so when you read the LPGA statement and, you know, you realize that this isn't on the title sponsor, Fairhills. This isn't on, you know, the company that organizes the tournament that puts it on, Outlier. This isn't on Sayre. This is on an underwriter, which, you know, apparently didn't pay the bills in 2024 either. So the LPGA couldn't afford to you know, step in and fill the gap here when you add, you know, what's the funds that were missing from 2024 and then not paying their bills for 2025. The tour's already having to pay a portion of the Founders Cup, which of course doesn't have a sponsor after Cognizant left. They do now have a presenting sponsor, but still, you know, the tour's going to have to pay some money out there. So, you know, overall, you know, what we're looking at is a situation where, you know, it was better for the LPGA financially to just cancel the tournament, which is really unfortunate and leads a lot of question marks going forward.
So, Beth Ann, let me get this straight. I'm just trying to be clear here. Is there any pursuit of exploring a rescheduling, or is this just not going to happen this year?
I think it's a very, very slim chance that it will happen this year. You know, I wouldn't, I mean, the tour is obviously going to go after that money and try to recoup it. But I would be shocked if if that event, you know, came back on the schedule. If it did, it would be probably somewhere in the fall. But I doubt we'll see, you know, anything taking place in the near future.
Going back to this week's event in Orlando, Beth, on the Hilton event, a couple of the biggest names in the game, right there, the two biggest names in the game are right there, Lydia Ko and Nelly Korda. Some big names are actually choosing to sit out this first week of the season. Does that surprise you in any way, given how odd the cadence of the LPGA season does tend to be in the first quarter of the year?
No, it's been happening for years. It's a bit of a trend, really, especially for players who, you know, are from Asia or from Australia, you know, on the other side of the world, and they want to spend, you know, more time at home. And now when you add the Grant Thornton in December, the LPGA's, you know, off season is even shorter. So, you know, I understand, you know, why players are making that decision. It's obviously unfortunate to see three of the top five players in the world not playing, and Gino Thitakun and Ronnie Yen and Lilia Vu. So, you know, it's in Lilia Vu's case, I'm guessing she's looking to have a little bit more time with her back and to get everything, you know, in order health wise. But you know, it's just a really tough start to the year when you have these two events kind of on an island and then they go off to Asia.
Beth Ann, as we talk about playing, not playing, it naturally leads me to Lexi Thompson, who at the end of the 20 announced her retirement at the end of the 24 season, but not so fast, right? Like we expect to see her a few times, most likely this season. Is that a fair leap to take?
Well, she's actually listed in the field for the Founders Cup next week. So the deadline for that to fully decide is tomorrow on Tuesday at 5 p.m. I emailed her agent. He said, you know, they're kind of on a day-to-day approach as far as what the rest of her year will look like. But Lexi can play in the Chevron Championship as long as she wants as a former champion. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see her get a little get a few reps in.
Well, we're certainly shrinking that gap between retirement and comeback, but we'd all be happy to see that. Beth Ann, thanks for the insight as always.
Thank you.
He's Eamon Lynch. I'm Jordan Cornette. It's hour number two of Golf Today. And on the heels of that Beth Ann Nichols conversation, Eamon, it seems like there's a lot of uncertainty in the women's game right now.
There's certainly a lot of volatility around the LPGA Tour. They've probably got the best roster of champions and engaging players they've had in a very long time, but certainly a lot of uncertainty around the executive leadership of the tour, Molly Marcoussi-Mann having stepped down, and also a lot of kind of uncertainty around some sponsors and whether or not the money is there to actually hold the tournaments they want to hold.
So that's most important.
We'll see as the 75th season kicks off for the LPGA Tour, and that starts this week in Orlando, Florida, at the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions. You can catch live first-round coverage from Lake Nona Golf and Country Club Thursday. That's at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Time right here on Golf Channel.
Hilton Grand Vacation Tournament of Champions, notable celebrities in the field. There's a ton of them. But the guy we're going to talk to now here is Taylor Twellman. He's an American former soccer player who played professionally from 99 to 2010, a former U.S. national team player. He won an MVP award in the MLS in 2005 following his playing career. He worked for ESPN and ABC as their lead soccer analyst, now doing his work with Apple TV as their lead analyst. This week, however, trading the mic for the golf clubs as he's teeing it up in LPGA Tour's Hilton Grand Vacation Tournament of Champions. Joining us now, my friend Taylor Twellman, ahead of it all. And, hey, Taylor, look, some people may think athlete, big name in the sport, he's going to go out there and mess around a little bit playing golf. But golf is in your DNA, my friend. And I watched in the American Century, like many did, finishing eighth there. And a lot of people thought you could have been one of the favorites. How do you feel about your game going into this one in Orlando?
First off, you two, longtime listener, first-time caller. So I appreciate you going down the Rolodex, and then everyone said, no. You know what? We can get 12 into it. They'll do this. The VHS pictures of me playing them a long time ago were great. Honestly, Jordan, golf's always been part of my family. Yeah. My uncle Jay Delsing was on the PGA Tour for 20-plus years. I had a good conversation with Corey Pavin last year when we played in the tournament in Dallas. And I just, Corey remembers me at age 8, 9, 10 coming over to the house. Now he's seeing me as a 44-year-old hitting a duck hook over his head on the golf course. It's been a lot of fun. Listen, I love it. It's everything opposite of what I did as a professional athlete. Eamon, you know this as a football fan. I could blame everyone else playing soccer unless I scored the goal. Now I can't blame anyone but myself. I can't even look at the caddy and blame him for giving me the wrong club. So it's been a humbling experience, to say the least.
And you're talking about real football, Taylor, not that kind of stuff that was consuming him.
Absolutely.
Yesterday. You've been in high-pressure situations professionally, Taylor. What is the difference between what you experience and train for professionally versus when you, like Caitlin Clark did recently, stand on the first tee with a driver in your hand and all you see is heads that can be broken down either side of the fairway?
Eamon, the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions, first tee shot, that whoop on my right wrist right now is hitting at about 175, 180 in a heart rate. When Lydia Ko's on your left, Brooke Henderson's on your right, whoever else you're playing with, it's unlike anything I've ever experienced, because you look down and whether you got a driver, hybrid, four iron, you know it's only you and nature. It's you against the course. It doesn't matter what anyone else does. It's actually very difficult to try to articulate that type of pressure, because in my professional career, and for majority of us, you physically could get rid of that anxiety, of that pressure, of that anxiousness. You could get in a tackle, you could get stuck in, you could run off that initial nervousness on the first tee. I can't do wind sprints on the first tee next to Lydia Ko, so needless to say, it's been an experience in and of itself, and it is a little bit of close your eyes and hope you hit it about 250 down the middle.
Well, Taylor, who are you fooling, man? We all know you love the bright lights, man. You thrive in those positions. Taylor, you mentioned Lydia Ko. I imagine she's one of many names, but who are some of those other names you're excited to brush shoulders with in events like this? Because you're not a newbie to them by any stretch of the imagination.
No, Jordan, it's just been a real pleasure. Listen, I've got two girls, 7, 4 years old, but more so, I'm a golf fan, and I would say this to all your viewers and all your listeners right now. Majority, if not all, the amateur golfers in the world should watch the women play, not the men play. Technically, they're sound. Their tempo's perfect. The way they go about their business is a great example and ambassadors to the game. But also, more importantly, they're badass. They get after it. They try to beat your brains in. And even if I'm hitting a driver further than them off the tee, they're putting from 15 feet for birdie while I'm trying to make a 6-7 footer for par. So whether it's Megan Kang, Brooke Henderson, Rose Zhang, Lydia Ko, whoever I've played with, all of them in and of themselves have been an example to me, and more so to athletes around the world, boys and girls, men and women, of how to be a professional athlete, but also how to be professional and also try to win. So when the Hilton Grand Tournament when that invite comes, I got to tell you, it's like I feel like a 12-year-old kid on Christmas Day, because I get to experience inside the ropes their sport while also thinking falsely that I'm going to be able to compete with them.
Taylor, you said in an interview a few years ago that golf kind of saved your life as your professional career in football wound down. What did you mean by that?
Great question, Eamon. My concussion, unfortunately, ended with concussions in 2008. And I missed the World Cup with the U.S. men's national team. My career was taken away from me. And I kind of went back to my roots of being a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, because I can't work out. I can't work out the way I was. I haven't worked out in almost 15 years of the way I used to. But golf got me away. There's no cell phone. There's nothing. It was me. It was nature. It's carrying a bag. It's walking 4 or 5 miles or whatever it was. It's playing any kind of athlete, whether you're big, fast, strong, short, tall, skinny, or heavy. Eamon, the best sport in the world. If you got a handicap, you and I can play a game. And so it helped me get out of my, so to speak, depression of not being able to finish the career that I wanted. And it's given me, listen, I'm not going to sit here and look at that camera and say it's a career, but it is a career of hope. It's a career of just being able to be competitive with people. For those of you that are watching that know me, I'm a degenerate gambler. I'll play any game you want, and I'll do it, and I'll do it to the best of my ability. Golf has given me that second life, and I'm not sure I'd be sitting here talking to you if I didn't find that in the time of my life when I needed it. And it's a real honor and privilege here to be speaking on behalf of Hilton and whatnot, because, Eamon, I'm not sure I would be here if it wasn't for golf.
And we also know you're a little bashful here. You're actually much more of a stick than you pretend to be. But you did hit on something interesting earlier and what it's like to play against the best women in the world and to learn from them. We all see a lot of keyboard commandos out there who are scratch at their local club who sit there and say, you know, I could go compete on the LPGA Tour. How delusional are those guys?
You should check them for concussions and not me, to be honest with you, Eamon, because I think they've lost a few brain cells. Anyone that's a keyboard warrior that watches the LPGA tournament this weekend on the Golf Channel on NBC, good luck. Good luck. That 5-foot putt for par that you just swipe up, pick up, and say it's a gimme. I've seen a lot of good players 3-putt those, me being one of those. For those of you that wonder what my handicap is at home, I'm a +1, +1.5, wherever that may be. I will struggle at the highest levels to be able to every shot concentrate and deliver in the manner that these women do. And so when you think in your right mind that you think you can compete with them, come on out. I'll invite you. We'll do a pro-am and make no mistake about it. They can give you about 25 strokes and they're going to beat your brains in.
See, I laugh because people are seeing Taylor right now, maybe those who don't understand his relevance and how heavy-handed he is in his sport and the great job he does. But this is authentically him. He is always – it's not the lights on right now. This guy attacks life this way, and it's very refreshing, Taylor. We look forward to seeing you out there this week.
Boys, thanks for having me on. I watch you guys all the time. Huge fans. And, Jordan, I kind of like the spectacles. It makes you look a little smarter, buddy.
I'm trying to hide it. You know, fake it till you make it, Taylor. I'm doing the best I can, man. We appreciate time, brother.
Now, the man behind Harris English is Justin Parsons, one of the finest coaches in the world. Couldn't help me, but he's been great for Harris English and for Brian Harman as well. Justin joins us now from the Monterey Peninsula. Justin, I believe you gave Harris something of a pep talk before play began at the Farmers Insurance. What was it?
Yeah, you know, Eamon, we've been working very hard to try and help Harris bridge the gap between the fine technical kind of structural work he's able to do and then being able to be, you know, more right brain free and be able to hit shots and see shapes and things like that. And that's kind of been a theme really since the Wyndham Championship. You know, we had a little bit of a chat on the Wednesday at Palm Springs and you know, he was wanting his golf swing to be a little bit better. And I actually ended up working with a different player, left the session, and his agent, Jeremy Elliott, kind of took over. Jeremy and I are close, and we had a nice chat. And he's basically saying, hit one around this tree and hit one around here. And, you know, in Texas that week at the Palm Springs, as I was leaving, I said, look, I want to see the golfer. I don't want to watch the golf swing this week. I want to see you as a player. And, you know, reiterating to Harris that, like, he can do things that a lot of other people cannot do in the game of golf. You know, his competitiveness and his ability to, you know, he talks about it and he puts the mouthpiece in and really grinds out good scores. And we saw that the type of Harris English that really I was used to seeing in 2021, where, you know, we saw beautiful tee shots, we saw great iron shots, we saw beautiful pitches and chips around the green, we saw a good performance on the green. So whatever the golf course required from him at the Farmers, he was able to deliver that. And, you know, he's one of the most gifted, most hardworking professionals that I've ever had the pleasure to work for. And part of our job is to try and, you know when the time is right to let them go, and know when the time is right to, you know, to get their alignment better, get their backswing in a better line.
Justin, it's cool to hear all that kind of backstory on what got Harris so locked in. But I also read that you told him to go back to what made him a winner in the first place. What did you identify in Harris that did make him a winner and ultimately got him to winning for the fifth time on tour?
When you get to know a player, Jordan, you know, as well as I get to know Harris, you can almost see in their body language and their demeanor. Particularly Harris has got, you know, this kind of locked in look that he has about his eyes when he's really in that frame of mind where he's, you know, he's put all of the sort of the technical things out the window, and he's put all of the, you know, the questions as to, you know, whether he's going to hit this shot or that shot. And, you know, when we can get him in that performance kind of flow state, especially on these difficult golf courses that he cherishes the Bay Hills and the US Open setups and the Torrey Pines setups. So, you know, being able to help him to lock in. And, you know, as I said to his caddy, Eric Larson, who's a great friend of mine, it's like you get to a point when they're locked in where you just have to stand back and let them do their job. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be working for some of the best players in the world. And they can't do, they can do things that others can't. You know, they can get to a level of concentration coupled with a level of technical acuity, which allows them to put in these big performances.
Curious how much of your role is psychologist as much as instructor, Justin, because Harris is coming back from a fairly complicated injury layoff. So while you're working on the technical aspects of the swing, presumably you're also trying to kind of build up the confidence that has eroded over the couple of years as well.
Well, Eamon, I tried some psychology work with you, but that certainly didn't work out in my favor. My mentor, Butch Harmon, said to me on a car ride once from the Floridian back to Orlando Airport. I was living in Dubai at the time. And I said, Butch, if you could have given a player, every player you work for, if you could have given them one thing, what would it be? And Butch said, you know, JP, if I had a bottle of confidence, I'd be a billionaire. And I think, you know, Butch would have liked to have been a billionaire. He didn't do too badly. But I think to your point, if you can find ways to give them a little bit more confidence, to help them trust in where they are, help them to understand that, you know, if they've got their name in their bag and they're, you know, they've, like Harris has had won four times, that's his fifth win, Ryder Cup player. If you can remind them of who they are and make sure you're getting the best out of them, you know, that's arguably as big a job as making sure they're swinging the golf club effectively. And it's something that is a real challenge to us in the coaching world, because we can look at any golf swing and we can spot the flaws in it. But when we look at maybe not Oberg's golf swing, but anyway, that's another topic. I think we could probably spot flaws in any swing, but when they're in that really good mentally locked in mindset, then they can perform. You know, even Harris, Eric and I talked a couple of nights ago when he hit that, you know, sort of hooky shot off the 18th tee on Saturday afternoon evening. He wasn't fazed. He just went down there and he said, okay, where do I need to put this in order to give myself a chance to make four? And very cool, calm and collected. And, you know, that's where wins are born.
You know, Justin, it's no micro surgery that Harris had a couple seasons ago that we just mentioned here and touched upon. It's a macro surgery. I mean, hip surgery, can you put into perspective, you know, just how difficult a recovery that is mechanically, technically, mentally, and to come back, not only compete, but come out here and be a winner and a guy that has a legitimate thought of, I'm going to be a part of this team and Bethpage and represent the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think from Harris's perspective, obviously he's had surgeries and somebody put a knife in his body and rearranged things. There's a mental component to that from the physical side. He's got 8 to 12, maybe in 15 degrees more internal rotation. That's kind of when you load your right hip in the backswing. And from my side, I noticed some slight changes in his posture, some slight changes in his alignment tendencies. A definite change kind of in the length of his backswing and how he was able to load his trail side. So there's a lot of different little things that work there. And you can imagine those things all take a little bit of time to kind of stabilize, both, you know, in the gym and as he gets himself more comfortable, and then he gets his kind of shot patterns back. So, you know, we're really, really pleased for him. Helen Marie and Amelia and his family, as I say, he's one of the most hardworking guys. You know, he oftentimes, I shouldn't say this, Butch would hate this, but he oftentimes beats me to work. I see his gray truck and he's in the gym as I'm coming in to get the studios ready. And he continues at 35 years old just to put the hours in, and we could see how much it means to him in his post-round interviews.
So often on tour, Justin, we see 20, 25 under par win out there. 8 under par was the winning score at the Farmers. A little of that owes to conditions, but it's also a pretty tough course setup. Harris was third at the US Open, played there just 4 years ago as well. What is it about this guy and kind of grinding out on tough golf courses?
You know, he talks about, if you ever remember the interview that Tiger Woods talked about, the fact that professional golf is like chess, and then really elite level professional golf is like another, or he said checkers, a really elite level form of professional golf is like chess. And I think Harris really enjoys that sort of challenge, like really knowing that, like, I have to position the ball here, I have to get the ball to here. He's not just as comfortable when it's a birdie fest, you know, where he gets in maybe and has a look at the leaderboard and somebody's already shot 9 under and a couple of guys are at 7 under. He feels like that bunches everything up. So he can really kind of separate himself with his level of focus and that ability to pick the golf course apart and to really stay in the present and be able to, as cliched as it is, just play one shot at a time. And we saw that, you know, he didn't hit a lot of fairways the final round, but, you know, he hit some great wedge shots, controlled his emotions, and that old putter of his seemed to warm up again.
Justin, always great to spend time with you. And remember, every time one of your guys wins, you're closer to being recycled as my next swing whisperer. That should motivate you in life.
That means a lot, Eamon. Thank you very much.
That is Justin Parsons.
This year marks the 25th anniversary of Tiger Woods' iconic 2000 season, which is arguably the greatest season in golf history. A season which saw 9 wins, including 3 major titles. It's going to be tough to duplicate. On the heels of the PGA Merchandise Show, we thought we'd focus on Tiger's impact on the growth of golf business throughout the years. And we welcome in now Dan Roberts, Editor-in-Chief of Front Office Sports. My good friend Dan, happy to have you on. We appreciate the time. And I want to start on a broader scale here. You know, different tours, dynamic investors, an uncertain future in the game of golf. How do you diagnose the status of the industry currently?
Well, good to be on with you guys. And I agree with you that maybe the PGA Tour and LIV and what happens there is still the biggest story. And it has been for about a year and a half. I think depending on how you slice it up, golf is in a good place. I mean, look at the year Scheffler had, and you've got a lot of exciting, dynamic players. You know, at Front Office Sports, we've written a lot about the rise of golf creators, like on YouTube and social creators. I think it's really hard to measure just how big those have been for the growth of the game and bringing in young fans. People talk about ratings and ratings for 2024 being down a little bit from the year before, but I often think too much is made of ratings. We'll see what happens with LIV and PGA Tour. LIV got their new deal with Fox. Interestingly, some LIV events are going to be on Fox Business Network, which I think says a lot. But there's intrigue, there's drama. We can get into the heyday a little bit. If you ask me, maybe it's going to be hard to get back to kind of the levels of the Tiger, Rory, Spieth dominant days. I mean, I'm always wondering who is the new face of golf, right? But that's a little bit like baseball. That's a perennial question we can dissect.
Dan, speaking of Tiger and Rory, they're going up against each other tonight in TGL, the simulator league that they're both founder members on. And this has been analyzed from almost every direction, you know, in terms of its product, the entertainment value, the competitive edge, the technological reliability. But it hasn't really been analyzed as an ongoing test of Tiger's economic muscle in this game. Do you think the Tiger brand is enough to kind of keep this thing going?
Well, look no further than the fact that the ratings went up for week 2 of TGL when Tiger did play. I mean, we sent our reporter Lindsay Zienti to week 1 of TGL. And what I kept saying is Rory and Tiger aren't participating in the debut of their own new tournament. I mean, those guys didn't play week 1. But I think you have to guess that it was intentional to save Tiger for week 2. The ratings went up. Then we had week 3. The ratings dipped. Surprise, surprise. When you add Tiger and Rory back into the mix, they're going to be able to point to it and say, oh, look, the ratings are up. I watched week 1 very closely at a bar with some golfer friends. You know, I'm a golf watcher. I watch all the majors. I'm not a golf player myself, and these are all golf guys. And I thought it looked kind of silly. I mean, we're looking at a simulator, and yet they all thought it was pretty cool. And golf Twitter, at least week 1, seemed to really like it. The numbers were pretty decent. I agree with you. I think you can draw a direct line from Tiger's impact on the game to the rise of participation, not just on the course, but off the course. The simulators that everyone has now. Our golf guy, David Rumsey at FOS, just wrote a story about how golf participation was way up for 2024 off course. So that is things like Topgolf, that is things like other virtual venues, simulators. And I think TGL is a real representation of that. So if you put Tiger's name on something new, it has a lot of sway. If Tiger participates, that has the ultimate sway.
Dan, not a golfer somewhere. His lovely wife, Claire, is smiling, not a golf widow. Let's go back, though, 25 years ago to prime Tiger. Just how staggering was his impact on the game when he was wowing everybody, growing the game simply by stepping foot on a course and swinging a club?
Oh, that 2000 year, Jordan, I mean, we're talking about 9 wins, 3 majors. I don't know that we'll ever see that done again. It's funny, I had an old editor at Fortune magazine who used to say, an anniversary is not a news peg. But we can talk about Tiger's 2000 season anytime we want. It happens that it's been 25 years right now. As I said, I think you can really credit Tiger with quite a lot in the modern game of golf, not just on ratings. And by the way, you know, when he was at his peak, or even look at 2019 with the Masters, when Tiger was in contention on the final day of a tournament, the ratings reflected it. I mean, there was just no substitute. You got that huge Tiger bump. And I think for many years, when I was covering the business of golf at Fortune and then Yahoo Finance, we would write about Spieth and Rory and Jason Day and Ricky Fowler. And it was always like, who's the next Tiger? And I'm sorry to say, I don't know that there is a next Tiger. I think he's a once in a lifetime talent and draw to the game. You just look at how he changed the business in terms of not just the course designing and the endorsement deals and a golfer being flooded on TV ads to the extent that he was, but regular mainstream sports fans who I think otherwise had no real interest in golf, snapping to attention when they heard that on a Sunday at a major or even a non-major, Tiger was in the hunt. You know, the famous footage of the crowds following him. Those clips are amazing to watch. So 2000, an incredible year. I've seen a lot of people in the last couple of months writing stories about how he only earned $10.7 million on the course that year. At the time, that was a record. But look at it now and adjust for inflation, it would be like almost $100 million. Fine. I always think the adjusted for inflation thing is a bit overstated. But forget just the on-the-course earnings. It's the impact on the business and showing just how much, in terms of the breadth of endorsements, a golfer could get.
On that subject of Tiger being a once-in-a-lifetime figure, Dan, he was never all that giving with the media. He certainly met all of his obligations, but he didn't give more than was necessary. In that context, Justin Thomas sent a memo to his fellow players last week asking them to be more giving of their time for broadcast partners to better sell their product. Is that we finally reached the point where these players have realised that they have a collective responsibility to sell their own product, that there is not that one iconic figure who does it for them anymore?
Well, I saw that, Eamon, and I thought for a few years already the players on tour understand that there's a burden on them to, I don't want to say be charismatic because you can't really change your personality, but to be figures who draw fans in, who do give time to the media. Right now over at the Aussie Open in tennis, we've had 2 weeks of consternation and discussion of the media and their role, and multiple tennis players saying that the reporters and the pressers are too cynical and too negative. On one hand, like, that's journalism. But on the other hand, you know, it's a give and take and a push and pull. And I do think it speaks to, I don't want to say it's an awkward truth, but it's the truth that there aren't that many guys in golf who are mega charismatic, draw in new fans, talents. You know, I love doing the debate. Who is the face of golf? Arguably, it's still Tiger after all these years, even though, you know, he's not out there winning tournaments. You can say it's Rory, who is really the face of the PGA Tour in the PGA versus LIV drama. I do think things like Full Swing have been huge for that. That helps. Players love being featured in that. I think Full Swing has become the model for other sports with trying to get your Netflix docuseries because it totally brings in new fans and it tells the players' stories. But they have to make themselves accommodating as well. I think they all know it. And, you know, unfortunately and respectfully to some of these guys, you know, a Scottie Scheffler, incredible on the course, but not really someone who I think is going to be the face of a whole sport and excite new fans, right? Ricky Fowler helps with that. You got some other exciting guys right now, young guys, Morikawa. But again, my take is, there's not going to be anyone ever again who's quite like Tiger. And you're right. The irony there is he never liked talking to the media. He was kind of walled off until he was sort of forced to be more accessible. And I think you've seen him visibly relax and breathe out and become a lot more fun with media and fans.
Well, Dan, a place where Tiger certainly is the face, we can agree, in golf, yes. No longer at Nike, now Sunday Red, the face of his new line there that is having great success. You're seeing it all over. A higher item line, if you will. What kind of success is Tiger having there? And where does that leave Nike in its relationship with golf?
Yeah, I think you can draw a direct line from the sort of end of Tiger's peak to Nike getting out of the golf equipment business in 2016, saying, okay, with things where they are and with Tiger where he is, I don't know that we need to make clubs and balls. 30-year relationship with Nike and in the latter half, $20 million a year in endorsement value. These numbers are astronomical. It's interesting, Tiger and Roger Federer both ending their relationships with Nike right around the same time, maybe a changing of the guard. And I think what you're going to see is more megastars like that either doing their own thing or working with a smaller brand where they can be much more involved and hands-on. Federer these days is doing stuff with On Running, which has really invaded tennis. And now Tiger has his own thing with Sunday Red. Of course, Sunday Red is with TaylorMade, so he still has those relationships with TaylorMade and Bridgestone. Interestingly, Sunday Red is dealing with a couple different logo disputes, including from Puma. And I don't know if Puma's going to be successful. You know, you'd have to ask my sister, who's a trademark law professor. She always says the litmus test is, would an average consumer be confused? Would an average consumer see Tiger's Sunday Red logo and think it's the Puma logo? I don't think so. But the fact that they're going after him is because they're seeing that this logo and this new brand is getting a lot of attention because it's Tiger Woods. Anytime Tiger's involved in something. I think it's really clever. I love the name. I love that he still wants to have his own brand and is pushing something in apparel. Again, it's like we said with TGL. If Tiger's got his imprimatur on something, it's probably going to be successful. If I were Nike, I'm not sure I would have let that relationship lapse, even if he's not winning. And same with Federer. The value of having these titans in your athlete portfolio is enormous, even when they're not winning tournaments anymore. So we are certainly covering the growth of Tiger's new brand very closely at FOS.
Dan, you guys have also covered quite a lot of the PGA Tour live dispute and the potential for a deal with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Fox Sports announced a broadcast deal recently with LIV. We keep seeing it reported that the rights fee involved is modest, to use their word. Do you have any sense of what this product is actually worth to the broadcaster, or are we just talking kind of nominal fees here?
I have also heard nominal fees, maybe even close to no or very small agreement up front, very little money changing hands. Let's remember, and respectfully to LIV, because they've made enough of a splash here that people care, and you know, it's a big deal when they face off at majors, the LIV guys versus the PGA guys. But, you know, I think LIV was kind of scrambling to get a new deal. I don't know that the CW is where they wanted to be. I said this off the top, but the fact that some LIV events are going to air on Fox Business Network kind of tells you a lot. It's anyone's guess what happens next in terms of the tie-up, but certainly merger was never quite the right word for what's going to happen between these two bodies.
Dan, we appreciate the time. Fascinating conversation on the business of the game and even taking a march down memory lane to a special time during the prime Tiger Woods era. Dan Roberts, Front Office Sports. Dan, we appreciate it. Welcome back to Golf Today. Last week, the USGA announced the 25 U.S. National Junior Team roster and the first ever U.S. Elite Amateur Program roster. The announcement also included National Development Program grant funding, which provides promising golfers in financial need with support. Building on last year's inaugural team of 18 athletes, the 2025 U.S. National Junior Team features 11 boys and 11 girls representing the country's elite junior golf talent. Teams made up of 14 returning players and 8 newcomers.
Well, the inaugural U.S. Elite Amateur Program consists of 3 men and 6 women with some recognizable names here like Jackson Coyvan, Anna Davis. It's designed to add support for top amateur players and their college programs to enhance their competitive development. For more, we welcome in Heather Daly Donofrio, who's the Managing Director of Player Relations and Development with the USGA. Heather, thanks for joining us. The USGA is clearly investing a lot of money in junior and amateur golf. What's the driving motivation behind this program?
Yeah, so many different things, Eamon. As you know, every sport in the U.S. has a national development program that guides their elite players, you know, from the junior levels all the way up to collegiate, professional, and even the Olympic levels. And golf hasn't had that for many years. And so we really want to provide that pathway to where we can support our athletes from the age of 13 all the way up to the collegiate and professional level, if they so aspire to do that, and provide the resources for them to be able to thrive both on and off the golf course.
Heather, what's the significance of these national teams and the elite amateur programs for young golfers? Can you kind of give us a better picture, an idea of what this looks like?
Yeah, sure. So we're really trying to provide them the tools to be successful both on and off the golf course and ultimately help them with that transition to collegiate golf and then to be successful at the professional level. We're doing that in a variety of ways. At the junior level in particular, we really want to instill a culture of team and competing with instead of competing against. So bringing these athletes together so that they can learn from each other through camps, through international travel, so that, again, we can prepare them for other cultures and playing on other types of golf courses, and then really finding what the individual athlete needs to help to be successful, whether that's help in nutrition, fitness and conditioning, sports psychology. And so we're really working with those junior national team kids as a group. Whereas with the Elite Amateur program, which we're just launching this year, we're taking a little bit more of an individual approach where we won't be bringing them together necessarily for camps, but our coaching staff will be going to them, working very collaboratively with their college coaches, and again, trying to find the gaps in their development and then identifying who's best to fill those gaps, whether it's our coaching staff, the national program, whether that's college coaches or whether it's somebody else. And we'll be bringing those elite amateurs to international competitions, again, to give them that exposure to help prepare them for the next level.
Is that individual approach how you kind of address the fact that not every golfer develops at the same pace, Heather? Because it's not really a one size fits all in this game in terms of the level at which people are expected to proceed into the professional ranks.
Yeah, 100% right. I mean, there's certain things in athlete development that go across all athletes, right? And we're working on an athlete development blueprint, which is developing athletes who thrive. But everybody advances at their own pace. Everybody develops at their own pace. I mean, I didn't even start playing golf until I was 15 and then had an 11-year career on the LPGA. So just because a player is not the best in the country at 15, 16 doesn't mean that they're not going to be one of the best professionals at 25 or 30. So we really do focus, and that's the I in Thrive, is individual development, really looking at how we can best prepare each individual athlete for their journey in the game. And knowing that it's a journey, I think a lot of, especially juniors right now, really focus on, you know, being great now. Well, we want our athletes to be great and healthy, both on and off the golf course, you know, for years to come and have long careers.
Heather, what does the future look like as the USGA and its partners continue to invest in these programs?
Yeah, we want to find ways to help more athletes. We want to continue developing resources for not only our national teams, but our grant recipients. We have 100 families on grants this year, and we want to expand that. And thanks to our donors, we should be able to do that. We affected more than 400 kids in our program last year in the first year of our program. Will be more than 600 this year. And in 4 to 5 years' time, we will be affecting we'll have more than 1,500 athletes in our program across the national teams, elite amateur programs, grants, and our state team. So, you know, continuing to develop our resources so that, honestly, if I could help all of the junior golfers reach their dreams in golf in America, I would do that. And we're on our way to supporting more and more athletes in future years.
Well, it certainly sounds like a program that we will see the fruits born of this in the years to come. Heather, thanks so much for explaining what's going on to us.
Yep. Thank you for having me.